Welcome to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. Each week, Jared will speak one-on-one with Department of Defense senior managers discussing policies and programs affecting warfighters and how the military meets its mission. On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. Glad you're with us this week. And as DoD continues the rollout of its 2014 budget on Capitol Hill in the midst of a very challenging and very uncertain fiscal environment, we're going to take a look at some of the long-term problems built into Pentagon spending, issues that are going to persist regardless of the overall size of DoD's top-line numbers. Our guest for the hour is one of the most seasoned defense experts here in the Beltway. Arnold Punaro is a retired Marine Corps Major General who now runs his own federal consulting firm, the Punaro Group. He's also a former top staffer for the Senate Armed Services Committee. Today, he sits on several influential boards and commissions. He's chairman of DoD's Reserve Forces Policy Board and a longtime member of the Defense Business Board. We spoke in his office in McLean, Virginia. We will spend the majority of this week's show talking about some of, I guess, what we would call the internal cost drivers that are going to make life difficult for DoD, regardless almost of what Congress appropriates. But let's spend a little bit of time talking about the here and now, the budget that just came out, sequestration, which after a year and a half of much weeping and gnashing of teeth, the department seems almost resigned to the fact that it's here to stay for at least the remainder of 2013. You agree, and is that a safe bet?
Absolutely. They're not going to fix the sequester that's already in effect for fiscal 13, and DoD is in the process of finalizing where they're going to take the cuts and then making the cuts. The sequester order was issued on March the 1st, and the total bill to the budget function in which the Department of Defense resides was a little over $42 billion. But that includes the base DoD budget, the overseas contingency or warfighting budget, and the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons programs. And they also included unobligated balances for prior years. So when you start doing all the arithmetic of what actually is going to be cut, there's about $36 billion that's coming out of the DoD's base budget, money coming out of the overseas contingency fund, that's a couple of billion. There's about $4 billion in the unobligated balances, and then the DOE nuclear budget, about $1.2 billion. However, just in the last couple of days, because of the way the 13 bill was finalized, some of the accounts were below the threshold for a sequester cut, and DOD has gotten a little bit of a gimme of about $3 billion. But the long and short of it is, in those accounts, they're cutting roughly $40 billion in the last 5.5 months of the fiscal year. So anybody that says that DoD can sort of absorb those kind of cuts without it having any negative impact is just nonsense.
So let's stay on that negative impact. In your estimation, how damaging and how recoverable are the impacts of what happens in 13?
It depends on who's doing the measuring. And the measuring ought to be our national security. We have a Department of Defense to basically help protect the United States of America at home and abroad, to prevent war, to prevent threats, but if need be, to engage in hostile action. So the thing that does that is the warfighting forces or the combat forces of our military. The most damage that is being done right now is to our warfighting capability. The readiness of our Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine units, particularly some of our frontline units, is going down each and every day because of lack of operations and maintenance and training money and maintenance money. When you look at a warfighting unit, I had the privilege of being the commanding general of a Marine Corps division for 3 years, and you measure your warfighting readiness, which is required, it's based on three things: your personnel, the training of those personnel, and your equipment. And you either have the people that are qualified or you don't. You have the requisite amount of training, and you have the equipment that's not on deadline. Right now, they're not able to train the forces. The equipment is on deadline, and in testimony before all the committees, the military uniform military leaders have said the warfighting readiness of our units is going down and it's getting worse every day. Unfortunately, it doesn't impact a local community. It doesn't impact the local economy. It doesn't make people wait in line at the airport. It doesn't make people sit on an airplane for an hour and a half at LaGuardia. So therefore, people say, well, the sequester is not hurting the Department of Defense.
And to stick with the Marine Corps, they have said in recent testimony that essentially if you're not deployed or next to deploy, you're not doing a whole lot right now. Based on your experience, what does that mean, that training that isn't happening right now?
Well, it means the units are not combat ready. They're less ready. They lose their edge. They lose their fighting skills. They don't have their equipment to train on. They aren't allowed to go train. And I guarantee you, just speaking, you know, with my Marine Corps background, it's going to be very frustrating for the individual Marines, because the Marine Corps, you know, is required to be the most ready when the nation is least ready. That was in the law in the 88th Congress. And they are being affected just like the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. And so I think it's a very serious situation. I mean, the world is pretty unpredictable. We live in a world of increasing threats, unfortunately decreasing resources, and it's very unpredictable. Just look at the bombings in Boston. And in the first pictures, you saw two people in uniform. Those were National Guard personnel. National Guard personnel were at that event, part of the first responders. There could be a hurricane. There could be a tornado. There could be another man-made disaster. Your forces need to be ready. They need to be at the cutting edge. And for the military, that's how they've grown up. That's what they know. And I guarantee you it's a serious matter when they aren't able to maintain their readiness levels. And by the way, once you go down, you don't just say, okay, guess what? We're now going to give you a blank check. I want you to move that unit from C3, not combat ready, back up to C1, razor edge readiness. It doesn't happen in a day. It doesn't happen in a week. It doesn't happen in a month. It takes probably 2 to 4 months to bring a not combat ready unit back up to where it can actually deploy and go.
And in terms of money, more money than it would have taken just to maintain them at a high level of readiness.
That's right, because once you lose it, it takes a lot more to bring it back. And when the vehicles aren't ready, I mean, you get them backed up, you know, you can't turn that on a dime. And the Air Force will tell you their pilots have to fly so many hours a month. Now, that doesn't mean they're not going to be great pilots, but the advantage the U.S. military has, what makes our military so far superior to every other military in the world are three things. One, the quality of our people, the training that we give them, and the technology that we give them. The sequester, because it hits the people, it hits their training, it hits their technology that the contractors can provide. It's basically attacking the three pillars of what makes our military the finest in the world.
That frustration that you mentioned at the fact that folks aren't doing what they signed up for, how long until that starts to turn into a retention problem? And I guess you could apply that to the civilian workforce as well. How long before the people that you most want to keep and who have the most options on the outside start running for the doors?
The really, really good, like you said, the really, really good people that you want to keep, if they look and say, this is only, you know, a 4-month thing or a 6-month thing, they can probably hold their breath and maintain. But if they say, wait a minute, are you kidding me? We're taking $1 trillion out of the defense budget between the budget control amendment and the sequester over the next 10 years. Does that mean I'm going to be, you know, in the rear with the gear sitting on my fanny, you know, for the next 4 or 5 years? I didn't sign up for that. So I think it's within the next 6 to 8 months, as we see this budget mess sort itself out, if it ever sorts itself out, it could have a on the people you really want to keep. Now, the people you don't want to keep, they're the ones that don't have a lot of options on the outside. So it's a bad situation to put the world's finest military in. Again, I think the department's leaders are very frustrated because these arguments don't resonate well with the American public. First of all, I don't think they articulate them as well as they could, but two, the average person doesn't identify with that. They expect the military is going to be ready no matter what.
Last thing on short-term issues before we move on. DOD has come in for some criticism in its 2014 budget proposal, assuming that sequestration goes away entirely and they go back to a more or less normal budget cycle next year. Should they have done something different? Could they have done something different to plan and prepare for what seems to be kind of a consensus in the think tank community around town, which is that at least sequester level cuts are going to be with us for the next 9 years, even if it doesn't take the current form that it's in.
I would make two comments on that. They aren't the only ones living in what I call bizarro world. The president's budget that he submitted is in bizarro world. Paul Ryan budget committee passed by the House budget committee is in bizarro world. The budget passed by the Senate led by Patty Murray is in bizarro world. And so DOD is in very good company. They're all in the three monkeys, see no evil, hear no evil, say no evil world, and thinking that if they all have budget resolutions and budgets that don't take the sequester into account, somehow it's mysteriously going to go away. Point number two is what DOD excels at is planning and budgeting. They're the best in the business. They're the best in government. They need long-term in a five-year plan, and they need a realistic five-year plan. So, and now Senator Levin, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, along with the ranking member, Senator Inhofe, have written to DOD and say, look, you need to send us a 14 budget that complies with the law that's currently in effect, which is $52 billion less. So I think DOD is going to take a hard look at how this plays out in the next couple of months. I don't think the department's leadership wants to be in the situation they're in right now, where you have this guillotine sequester whacked on you with 5 months left to go, and you have very little flexibility in terms of where you make the cut. They're doing the strategic management and choices review in the Pentagon right now, which their Secretary Hagel has said, okay, folks, we're going to be tightening our belt, probably tightening our belt a lot more than we really wanted to. We better look at our priorities, and everything's on the table, and we've got to make some tough choices. So I think DOD is beginning to step up to the plate, but I don't agree with the ones in the think tank that point fingers at the department alone. I mean, we ought to be pointing fingers at everybody in government, but particularly the Congress. The people that have been most derelict in their duty has been the United States Congress, not the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
Retired Major General Arnold Pinaro is our guest this week on DOD. Back after a short break, and we'll start digging into some of DOD's long-term budget issues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is on DOD. Our guest for the hour this week is retired Marine Corps Major General Arnold Pinaro, now the CEO of the Pinaro Group. Before the break, we focused on DOD's immediate budget troubles. We'll spend the rest of this hour on long-term challenges that he says are going to dog the department forever unless there's reform.
Let's start with personnel, which is an area I know you've spent a lot of time on in your capacity as chairman of the Reserve Forces Policy Board. When you look at the overall personnel system, I know you refer to these things as ticking time bombs in the DOD budget. I mean, what are the biggest drivers there that should and probably are worrying the department the most?
I think, again, you have to step back and take the long-term view, and you have to recall, and I served in the military in Vietnam as an infantry platoon commander. I stayed in the reserves. I went to work on Capitol Hill in 1973. We were still in Vietnam. So I was in on the initiation of the all-volunteer force. Mm-hmm. President Nixon asked former Secretary of Defense Thomas Gates to chair a commission in 1970 to make a recommendation on whether we ought to stay with the draft or go to what was then called the all-volunteer force. The commission made such a recommendation. Yes, we should go to the all-volunteer force. It started in 1973, but the commission said we will not be able to sustain or afford the all-volunteer force unless you make three fundamental changes. Fundamental change number one was get rid of the 20-year cliff retirement, which basically incentivizes people to leave when they're most productive. Number two, you have to get rid of the upper-out promotion system. And number three, you have to change the pay and compensation system from time and grade, meaning you get paid based on how long you've been in the military and what your rank is, as opposed to skills and performance. So he recommended all three of those changes be made. None of those changes have ever been made, and we are now paying the price of what the commission predicted would be an unaffordable growth path for all three of those things. The other thing you have to come back and look at is the military retirement system, the upper-out promotion system, and the pay and compensation system are antiquated World War II systems. These were not designed for modern times and modern personnel management. Number two, just like on the domestic entitlement side, the retirement programs were put in place when people died at age 60 and on the active military. We didn't pay them anything. My father-in-law was retired Navy commander, and his pay was peanuts, and you know, they retired, and people died at 60. Social Security, the reason they picked the retirement age at 65 is most people didn't live to 65. Now we have the average lifespan in the military for a retiree that retires at age 43 lives to 85. And so this dramatically increasing number of people that live a lot longer and draw these retired pays, and number two, the significant increase in the compensation that we put into the military for the volunteer force, those two combinations have caused tremendous cost growth that's really unsustainable, according to former Secretaries of Defense Panetta and Gates, former Chief of Staff of the Air Force Ron Fogelman. So from a policy-based standpoint, these are fundamentally flawed management systems and promotion systems, retirement systems that we have in place today. Number two, they're hugely expensive. And the all-in cost of the volunteer force, it's not just retirement and pay. It's the health care. The health care has gone from $17 billion to $30 billion to $50 billion, and without some fundamental reforms there, most estimates are it's headed to $70 or $75 billion. The people that use the health care system, there's 9 million beneficiaries, of which 5.5 million are retirees and their dependents. The military has about 3 million, and that's going to go down. To show you how inefficient that health care system is, the military treatment hospital is, those are the big military hospitals on base. Many of them are 50% underutilized. Some of them are at 20 to 25% utilization. In the civilian hospital world, if you're not at 88%, they shut it down. We run a DOD-dependent school system that costs $2.5 billion a year. We run the world's largest child care system in the military. We subsidize a grocery chain $1.3 billion a year. So when you start looking at the all-in cost of the volunteer force, it's not just the amount of money that you pay the people. And by the way, the enlisted and the officers now are well paid. They're at 88th percentile of their civilian counterparts. Doesn't take into account the risk factor, but those are just the tip of the iceberg costs, the huge fully burdened costs of the infrastructure that you have to support the military. That's why I call it a ticking time bomb, because all anybody ever wants to talk about is the person's paycheck. And just like in the civilian world, your paycheck is probably one of the smaller parts of the personnel compensation. It's the all-in cost. And so that's what the department has not come to grips with. That's what the Congress has not come to grips with. And that's what's, you know, driving the active duty military to get smaller and smaller.
So we've had this all-volunteer force that, as you say, the Gates Commission predicted would become unaffordable. We've had it in place for in excess of 30 years. It seems like to me the real problems have come up in the last 5 or 10 years when the costs have really exploded. Is that all health care, or is my fundamental assumption wrong? Has it been spiraling in this direction for a very long time?
We actually had tremendous struggles in the 70s to keep the all-volunteer force from totally collapsing. My old boss, Senator Sam Nunn, was chairman of the Manpower and Personnel Subcommittee on Armed Services, and I worked as one of his key staffers in that area before I became the staff director of the committee. And we, you know, you had huge quality problems in the Army and Marine Corps, huge recruiting and retention problems in the late 70s and early 80s. And we put in place then a huge amount of programs and benefits to basically save the volunteer force and to go and increase the quality. But your point is well taken. Steve Daggett, one of the best analysts that the Congressional Research Service has ever had, he's passed away here in recent years, but he was considered the world's expert in these areas, indicated that Congress added in just one decade of the 2000s $190 billion to the personnel accounts that DOD didn't even ask for. I mean, we've gone through a period when there was no benefit known to anybody that either the Department or the Congress wasn't throwing at the budget without any looking at the long-term consequences. When you look at the most expensive new benefit we've added on the entitlement side in recent memory, the TRICARE for Life program, you can't find any debate on the Senate or House floor on that issue. No one talked about what the long-term costs were, and it was just thrown in there. And it's hugely costly benefit for an unlimited benefit where they pay very little, you know, for it. They basically pay, you know, about $550 a year for an unlimited benefit.
Yeah, which, explain what that is for people that don't know. That's essentially a Medigap plan for people who are
Medicare
eligible.
We provide health care for the active duty military and their families, and I don't think we ought to change that. And we certainly ought to make the military treatment facilities more cost effective, and we certainly could get rid of a lot of bloat in the medical bureaucracy. The current Assistant Secretary for Health Affairs is Dr. Jonathan Whitson, a former Brigadier General in the Army Reserve. He's a vascular surgeon. And I've had a chance to visit with him in the hallways in the Pentagon and other places. And my question to him was, well, Dr. Whitson, you're a vascular surgeon, correct? Yes. That's about veins and arteries, yes. Well, let me ask you this. Are the veins and arteries in a person wearing an Army uniform, a Navy uniform, an Air Force uniform, Marine Corps, are they the same? Well, yes, they are. Well, why do we have these three huge medical establishments? There's 9,000 duplicative overhead spaces between the three. We have underutilization in the military hospitals. We have huge number of administrators and personnel to run these three mammoth service bureaucracies. Then you have a huge OSD, TRICARE Management Activity bureaucracy. So there are lots of extra folks in that area. But that supports the active duty military. Then you have the medical system that supports those that retire, mostly between the ages of 43 and 45. Of the people that join the U.S. military, this is a very, very important point, because the critics of those like myself who want to reform and improve the system and actually save the system for the long-term future, they say and imply that when you talk about reforming health care or retirement and things like that, you're taking money out of the pockets of the troops fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Nothing could be further from the truth. 80% of the people that join the U.S. military never earn or get a nickel of the retirement benefits, including retirement health care benefits. Of the people that fought in World War II, my dad never saw a nickel. Korea, all the young Marines that fought, draftees that fought with me in Vietnam, Desert Shield, Desert Storm, the vast majority of the people that have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 12 years will never have a nickel of this benefit. It only goes to the 17% that stays for 20. Of that 17%, 75% of them retire at career year 23 or less. Why? They're incentivized to get out then because they can retire at age 43 to 45. So this is where the real increased cost in the medical is in the benefits is for these cohort of individuals that get out at age 43 and they live to age 85.
That's Arnold Panaro, CEO of the Panaro Group, a retired Marine Corps Major General and former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee. We're back after a quick break with more on what he calls ticking time bombs in the DoD budget. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbia. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbe. Thanks for listening as we explore some of the structural, long-term problems in the DoD budget with Arnold Panaro, the chairman of DoD's Reserve Forces Policy Board, retired Marine Corps Major General, and CEO of the Panaro Group. Before the break, he talked with us about the need to reform DoD's retirement system, a benefit that's growing more expensive, but that most military members never even receive.
Given what you said a moment ago, the fact that only one out of five military members ever get any kind of retirement benefits, why is there such a fierce constituency to protect this 20-year cliff vesting system, and why is there no clamor from inside the military for some kind of reform that would benefit the other four-fifths of uniformed service members?
That's a good question. I can't answer that question. I don't really know. I can speculate. I will say to you that it's really disappointing to me that many of the military associations, which grew up in the late 70s and early 80s, where they primarily were arguing for a strong national defense, they were arguing for, you know, merit-based things for the troops, have turned into lobby groups for benefits for their members. That's not wrong. I mean, it's certainly permitted under our laws, but the notion somehow that they're the good guys and the people that are criticizing the system are the bad guys, they're paid lobbyists. They get paid to argue to Congress for benefits and more benefits for their members. They're no different than the people that lobby for the National Rifle Association, the American Association of Retired People, the petroleum distributors, the beer distributors. They're paid lobbyists. And so I don't think they're always dealing with the objective facts, and I don't basically see to them that everything they say is merit-based. They're the beneficiaries of the system, by the way. They're all enjoying those benefits. And a lot of the senior people in the military that make the key decisions are going to be beneficiaries of those benefits. So I think there's an inherent conflict of interest in a certain extent. They always say, well, we don't, it's going to hurt recruiting and retention. I've been around a long time. I've seen many studies. There's never a study that I've seen that demonstrates that a 17 or 18-year-old joins the U.S. military because they're thinking about what they're going to earn in retired pay 20 years from now. Just factually wrong. When we reformed the military retirement system in 1986, because it was getting ready to go under Grand Rudman Hollings, and tried to incentivize people to stay longer, and grandfathered everybody for 20 years, during the 17 years before the military got on their high horse and convinced Congress to flip it back, there were no recruiting or retention problems. So this notion somehow that the changes that people like myself advocate, where you would still grandfather everybody for 20 years, are somehow going to gut recruiting and retention, there's just no factual evidence to base that. So I think the bottom line is they're paid lobbyists, and they're very good at what they do. And by the way, it doesn't take a lot of profiles and courage in Congress to raise somebody's benefits and give them more money.
One thing that puzzles me, DOD regularly says that their personnel costs are out of control, but it seems like the options that they prescribe to Congress for getting them under control are relatively limited so far. There are things like, you know, slowing the rate of growth in basic pay and marginally increasing fees on TRICARE retirees. I mean, am I wrong, or could or should they be making some more ambitious proposals to Capitol Hill?
They definitely should. I mean, that is, those changes, while needed, and even though they've been mightily resisted by Congress, aren't going to even get close to fixing the ticking time bomb in the personnel and compensation, retired and healthcare area. And frankly, you know, you would hope that senior leaders would not be faced with the Hobson's choice of picking between, you know, highly trained and ready riflemen and happy retirees. But we're there already. And the system, both in the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, their recent decisions, they're a lot more concerned about happy retirees than they are highly trained riflemen. I think it's a very sad situation that we're in, particularly as the readiness of our combat forces deteriorates. If they don't get some fundamental reforms going in these key areas, and by the way, as I've said, you've got to grandfather everybody for 20 years, so it takes a long time to change the up-out system in a thoughtful, deliberative way. It's going to take 2 to 3 years to, you know, address the legislation and pass it. Same thing with retirement, same thing with health care. I don't advocate you change these things overnight. But, and people say, well, Arnold, why take the pain, because you're not going to save any money? But just hypothetically, if you went on military retirement, if you went from a high 3 to a high 5, mm-hmm. meaning your retired pay would be based on your last 5 years of pay, not your last 3, if you went from a 2.5 multiplier each year you're in times your base pay to a 2.0, so take a 5/10 off, and if you basically push the retirement age to a more meaningful age, recognizing that people are living 30 years longer than they did when the first retirement age was established, you could save $250 billion just in the next 10 years in what we call the accrual funds. That's not an insignificant amount of money, and that would be money that could be spent for bullets and riflemen and things like that, and not spent on just sending money to a trust fund. And you could still grandfather everybody for 20 years. And so you can make these fundamental reforms and have significant savings. That's one reason Congress has created this commission to look at all these benefits. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take a thoughtful, deliberate report. The stuff that the Pentagon, God bless them, because they keep charging that hill and they keep getting mowed down by the congressional, you know, machine guns, they need those changes. But they're really basically drops in the buckets of what needs to be changed. We need the fundamental reform that Thomas Gates and his commission recommended in 1970 when we created the volunteer force.
Arnold Pinaro is a retired Marine Corps Major General. Now, among other titles, he is the chairman of DOD's Reserve Forces Policy Board and CEO of his own federal consulting firm, the Pinaro Group. We'll be back for one more segment with him after a break. This is on DOD, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Sermon. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Wrapping up our hour with Arnold Pinaro, CEO of the Pinaro Group, a retired Marine Corps Major General and former Staff Director of the Senate Armed Services Committee. We're stepping back from DOD's short-term budget problems and talking about the long-term challenges that he calls ticking time bombs in the DOD budget, with a particular focus on personnel spending this hour. He noted in our last segment that DOD's proposed some modest changes to slow the growth rate in that area, but in his words, they keep getting mowed down by the machine guns of Capitol Hill.
Well, another one of those areas where they keep getting mowed down, it seems to me, is BRAC. They keep coming forward with that proposal, and Congress has no interest in it whatsoever. Is that relatively important, very important, in terms of bringing costs under control? I don't think we even know how much excess infrastructure is out there, but the department
it's
thinks
hugely
it's north
important.
Of 20%.
It's hugely important in bringing overhead costs under control. I would say last year when they asked for it, it was a throwaway. They hadn't really done the analytical work.
Yeah.
They hadn't done the homework, and they just threw it over the transom, and they knew it wasn't going to get approved. This year, they're asking for around at FY15 and FY17. It looks like they've done a little bit more analytical work, but they haven't really, in the department, done all the work they need to do to show what the excesses are and also to show that this next round is going to have to be more about the joint activities, depots, supplies, warehouses, labs, kind of the cross-cutting functional areas as opposed to Navy bases or Army bases or Air Force bases and things like that. And number two, I think DOD has got to admit and just be honest about the 2005 BRAC round was just dumber than dirt, and that and just write it off and say, look, Rumsfeld and his colleagues didn't have a very sound approach. It hasn't really saved any money. It did a lot of stupid things. So let's quit using that as an excuse and hiding behind that, and let's go back and look at how well the real BRAC rounds work. So I think they're going to have to admit that because Congress keeps hiding behind that. So we have too much infrastructure. I mean, the point again is this. You know, why do we have a military? We have a military to put them at the tip of the spear, not in the rear with the gear. We have too much rear area activities. If we can't get at any of these overhead accounts, then your tip of your spear is just going to get smaller and smaller and smaller, be less well-equipped and less well-trained, and the folks in the rear with the gear will just still be there.
I mean, could the department be making a better case to Congress on this? I mean, could they be saying, for example, look, BRAC doesn't necessarily mean we're going to shut down Fort Rucker or Luke Air Force Base, but we do need to reduce infrastructure probably kind of everywhere, and as you said, in the joint activities.
They certainly could and should make a better case. What I said was their case is better than it was last year, but it's probably pretty far off of what, if I was still up there as a staffer and a staff director of the Armed Services Committee, I would consider their analytical arguments to still be pretty mediocre. So, but they've got a better case. They just haven't put it on paper yet, and they haven't done the analytics. My hope would be that they improve that and they at least get something on the books for FY17. Congress is never going to give them anything as close as FY15. The other thing they should do is look at having the legislation approach it differently. For example, right now, when you close a base, state and local government gets first crack at that excess land. It takes state and local government forever to figure out if they want to do anything, and they don't really have the resources. If, for example, you had a depot that was, you know, excess, but you let a private contractor, one of our big contractors, come in and put their facilities on that depot and run that depot and keep jobs and do it more efficiently and effectively, that would make a lot of sense. The current legislation doesn't let you do that. So there are a lot of things that ought to be done to modify the BRAC legislation to make it more palatable once something, you know, gets closed down. Let's face it, it's all about jobs. That's why the congressmen don't want to see the bases closed. So the point is, okay, how do we basically show them that we're going to keep a lot of jobs in their area and utilize those facilities differently than they're being utilized now? DOD needs to make that case.
That's a great point. Switching back to personnel, in your capacity as chairman of the Reserve Forces Policy Board, your latest report came up with some new basically costing methodologies, I guess is the way to say it, for the active component, the reserve component, civilians, and contractors, I believe. There are gaps in data in the Defense Department right now. They do not know how much those different buckets of people cost. Talk a little bit about why that's a problem and what DOD could do with good data if it had it.
First of all, anything in the Department of Defense, you need to have objective analysis. You need to have objective data to basically make more informed and more intelligent decisions, particularly in the area where most of the cost is, which is personnel. And they don't have it today. In a lot of cases, I don't think they want to know what those costs are because they know they're going to be so high, people are going to go, you know, and have the big gulp, and they're going to have to justify why those costs are so high. you need to know right now, as we're trying to figure out the future mix of our military, you should know the fully burdened and life cycle cost of an active duty person, the fully burdened and life cycle cost of a Guard and Reserve person. You should know the same thing for a defense civilian, and you should know the same thing for a contractor. So when they're looking at these decisions about downsizing and less money, what is the right mix between active, Guard and Reserve, defense civilians, and defense contractors that will allow the mission to be performed in the most cost-efficient and effective way? If you don't know what your costs are, you can't make the best decision. When it comes to the active duty military, they're far short of knowing what the fully burdened and life cycle costs are. And they don't use those for any of their analytical decision making. They pretty much use paycheck costs. Mm-hmm. I got started on this because when I took over, when Secretary Panetta asked me to chair the Reserve Forces Policy Board, one of the questions that got posed to me, well, Arnold, why is the Guard and Reserve more expensive than the active duty military? I said, where the heck are you hearing that? He said, well, I'm looking at all these papers that they send in about this, and I look at them and go, holy smoke, these things are fundamentally flawed. So I throw a question back to people, and I bump into four-star military people in the halls of the Pentagon. Hey, Arnold, how is the Guard and Reserve more expensive? I said, let me ask you this. There have been 850,000 Guard and Reserve personnel mobilized for Iraq and Afghanistan, and all but about 50,000 have been demobilized. So how many DOD-dependent schools or commissaries or new military hospitals or barracks or family housing units or tactical equipment shops did we build to support those 850,000 that were mobilized, and how many have we torn down now that 800,000 of them have been demobilized? The answer is zero, because the Guard and Reserve does not have the sunk cost that you have for an active duty unit. So if you want to talk about, if they want to talk about, well, here's what we pay them when they're activated, where they're paid pretty much equivalent to what an active duty, because they're on active duty when they're mobilized. But they, what they don't want to talk about is, here's what it costs to basically have the active duty 365 days a year, and here's what it costs to basically pay the Guard and Reserve, which are about 80% cheaper. If we'd had to have 850,000 additional active duty personnel to basically fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan on duty 365, it would have cost another $1 trillion, which obviously the nation can't afford. So to me, it's just hard to even fathom that people actually believe. But that's because the active duty military doesn't appreciate, doesn't know, doesn't care what it costs to have a soldier, sailor, airman, and marine on active duty 365 days a year. They just say, oh, well, that's just the cost of doing business. Well, that cost is astronomical. That's why it costs about $400,000 a year for an active duty soldier.
One of the theories I've heard about why the civilian and contractor workforce has grown the way it has over the last 10 years is that active duty manpower has basically priced itself out of the market. Is that right?
Well, I think the all-volunteer force has priced ourselves out of the market in terms of any ability to surge on the active duty side. Now, we did surge in the Army and the Marine Corps during the wars. They're taking that surge number back down. But as you know, when people started talking about increasing the number of troops in Afghanistan, it cost, you know, over $2 billion a year for 10,000 soldiers. You know, when you add in all the cost of their pay and the personnel and the benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's a life cycle cost. So it's not just, we pay people now on active duty 60 years to serve for 20 years. So I have no problem with what we pay them while they're serving and they're out there on the tip of the spear. Now, a lot of the people in the military are not on the tip of the spear. But then we pay them for another 40 years after that. That's what's why the system is broke. I mean, nobody can afford that in the world that we live in today. Look at what's happening in the civilian economy. Firefighters, police, teachers, they're all reducing their long-term pension costs. So it's these pension costs that are breaking the bank. And then, of course, it's the support costs when you have to run the equivalent of a small town on a military base, because that's the way they like it. Why do we still have schools on military bases here in the United States of America? Well, the commissary was put in effect when the Army had posts out in Indian country and they didn't have any supplies. And yet we still have, it's just like the military retirement system, which is anachronism from the 1900s in World War II. We still have things that are in place in the military today that were put in place years and years ago, and they've never gone back and taken a fresh look at them. You add all this stuff in, it's just, the costs are just astronomical.
Well, Arnold Pinaro, it's been a really quick hour, but it's been really fascinating, too. Thanks so much for doing this.
Quite welcome. Anytime.
Retired Marine Corps Major General Arnold Pinaro is the CEO of the Pinaro Group, also a member of the Defense Business Board, and the chairman of DOD's Reserve Forces Policy Board. We'll post a link to that Reserve Forces Policy Board report that we mentioned on fully burdened personnel costs at federalnewsradio.com. You can also hear our full one-hour interview there if you missed any of our discussion this week. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of On DOD. Very glad you could join us. Please join us again in this time slot next week. I'm Jared Serban. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.